morning, everyone. So today we are going to be shifting gears just a little bit and entering a new phase of the course where we, instead of talking about high-level concepts or things like architectures and operating systems, we're going to start drilling down, and we're going to proceed from a, you know, maybe lower-level language than you had seen previously, namely C, all the way down to assembly language and eventually machine language over the course of several lectures. So today we're going to start by looking at assembly language. And this is going to happen over the course of about four different lectures, as well as a bunch of precepts. So the goal in lectures is going to be to, you know, study the main constructs, study partial programs, whereas in precepts, you're going to be looking at, you know, how to put those together into really complete programs. We're going to proceed in order of complexity of constructs, and the emphasis is going to be on learning to read assembly language code in lecture, and in precept, you're going to be focusing on writing that code. So we'll start by what it is that I mean when I say high-level language versus a low-level language. Now, high-level languages have the characteristic of being relatively portable. There still might be a few little corners that are machine-dependent and architecture-dependent. High-level languages tend to be relatively complex in the sense that a single line of code, a single statement, can actually involve lots of different operations. I mean, if we look at something like this, you know, this is a single line of code, but it has a first of all, looking up a variable, multiplying it, adding something to it, assigning the result back to another variable. So if you think of the amount of code that you write versus how much work actually gets done, there's probably kind of a good ratio of functionality to code size. And high-level languages are intended to be very much human-readable and easily debuggable. So part of this is that they are structured. They have high-level constructs like if, while, things like this. You have this concept of variables. The variables are typed, so the compiler can do a lot of checking for common errors for you. And once you have allocated a variable somewhere, which is done using, you know, slight differences, you know, maybe you write static here or something like that, once you've done that, you can write the rest of your code not really worrying about what that variable is, where it lives. On the other hand, we have low-level languages, where a lot of this stuff isn't true, which is why they are so much harder to write, and especially so much harder to read. So the lowest level language of all is a machine language. So this is very much not portable. It is very specific to the hardware architecture that you're operating on. It is a simple language, so each instruction does one thing. And really, reading code like this takes a lot of effort. It involves not only deciphering each instruction, but actually going down to the bit field and figuring out which bits out of which instruction tell you to do various things. So in practice, you know, in the old days, this was, you know, a very manly thing to do, to write raw machine language. But it might be treated more as a quirk, as a thing you do because it's there, not because you really have to, with some exceptions. You know, there might be circumstances where you really do want to read and write tiny bits of machine language. An assembly language is somewhere in the middle. It is a human-readable form of machine language. So there's a one-to-one correspondence between a machine language and an assembly language. So it still, you know, has some of the characteristics of the machine language. It's very much not portable. But it is intended, at least, to be more human readable, but it is another language, so you have to learn the language, and that's what we're really going to be doing over the next couple of weeks. So why learn assembly language? Obviously it helps you write faster code by rewriting high-level language code in assembler. You might be able to take advantage of additional constructs that are available to you in assembler. But even knowing how assembly language works and how your C code or your Java code is going to get translated into assembly language can help you in writing good, efficient, high-level code. Understanding assembly language is also very important for understanding safety of code, especially if you're writing in a language like C that doesn't put a lot of guardrails on what you do. You know, we're going to actually be able to directly see the consequences of dereferencing pointers that you really shouldn't dereference. We'll see how that shows up in assembly language. Or, more pertinently, accessing outside of array bounds and accessing outside the bounds of memory that you've allocated, which C does not prevent you from doing, and can cause some really bad things to happen to your program and to your system. So we really want you to understand what's happening under the hood, and we want you to become more familiar with this concept of levels of abstraction. That even though you're writing in a high level of abstraction, you're writing in this high level language, understanding what's going on under the hood can help you do a better job of that. So in this course this year, we are going to be using the ARM version 8 64-bit assembly language. So ARM is a collection of architectures that dates back to at least the 80s, maybe the 70s even. It was developed originally by a company called Acorn, hence the A in ARM. And these days, it is the most commonly used processor architecture in the world. The phone in your pocket runs a chip that uses the ARM architecture. If you have a recent Mac, like bought this year, it uses a chip that uses the ARM architecture. Obviously, ARMLab, obviously a lot of kind of, you know, little Internet of Things devices, they all run on ARM. Really, the only exception is boxes that run Windows, a lot of server systems, and, you know, older Macs. Those run on a different architecture called x86, which was developed by Intel, and again has evolved over many, many generations since the 1970s, really. So we're going to be using ARM. It is a kind of a relatively modern architecture because it is version 8, and it was developed to be kind of sitting alongside earlier versions. Therefore, it doesn't have a lot of the compatibility cruft that things like x86 have, which were developed to really resemble the earlier versions of the x86 architecture. So it is a relatively clean, relatively modern, relatively elegant instruction set. I always say elegant because, you know, it has its own little quirks. You'll see as we get into machine language in a couple weeks that sometimes you have to put a couple bits here, a couple bits there, for historical reasons. Oh well. So let's start by looking at not just the instructions, but first let's start by looking at the architecture. And by computer architecture, what I really mean is more than just the instructions that get executed, it's the environment on which those instructions get executed. By architecture, I mean how do those instructions affect the registers in the CPU, how do they communicate with memory, what capabilities do the instructions have? And to talk about architectures, we have to talk about John von Neumann. So John von Neumann, huge pioneer in computing. He really popularized the concept of stored program computers. In other words, computers where you can write a piece of software and then, you know, without rewiring the computer, actually execute that software. That was kind of a major development in the history of computing. He's also, by the way, if you've taken COASE 226, the developer of Merge Sort. He was also, you know, a very early pioneer in game theory, as well as a lot of other areas of mathematics. And he became an expert in explosions and the modeling of explosions and shockwaves using very early computing devices, and therefore became very involved with the Manhattan Project. So, colorful character, really interesting life, and a Princeton connection. He was at Princeton and the Institute from 1930 really until his death in 1957. Nice little article there where you can read up on him. Anyway, so von Neumann developed the general principles of computer architecture that are still in use today. And it is called the von Neumann architecture. And the main concept there is that programs look just like data. Programs in machine language are stored in good old memory alongside data. The processor accesses the code the same way as it does the data that the code runs on. So the code and the data are both stored in the same memory. They're both accessed in the same way. And this is known as the von Neumann architecture, or sometimes the Princeton architecture. Be proud of that, yo Tigers. As opposed to the obsolete Harvard architecture. Boo Harvard. Yay. All right, so what do we mean by von Neumann architecture? So this is the kind of really high-level diagram of what's going on in a processor, and really all modern processors. The heart of the CPU is this orange device right there that we call the ALU, the arithmetic logical unit. So that's the thing that is performing your adds, your multiplies, your whatever operations you're doing, your tests, your branches. It is controlled by a control unit that knows how, you know, what it's supposed to be doing by reading instructions from RAM, from memory. So instructions come up from memory, go to the control unit, it reads the instruction, it deciphers what the instruction is meant to do. It then does a couple of different things. It might cause data to flow between memory and registers. Registers is a set of, really tiny amount of memory on the CPU itself, as we discussed last time. Or it might cause the ALU to do an operation on some data that it got from the registers. Okay, so registers are the top of the storage hierarchy. On the ARM architecture, you'll see that there are just over 30 of these. They are each about 64 bits long, so not a whole lot of memory at all. ALU instructions operate on registers. So the ALU figures out what operation you're trying to do. It might take a couple of operands from the registers, perform an operation, stick the result back in a destination register, and optionally, set some flags depending on what happened with the instruction. Did the instruction succeed? Did it cause an overflow? Did it cause the result to be zero? So all of these things, ALU can note down. and that can then be used by future instructions. So RAM, the memory, it's a, you know, we think of it as just a large array of bytes that can hold either data or instructions, machine language instructions. So very important, instructions are fetched from the RAM. So in a nutshell, that is this, the description of all modern computers. They all operate roughly the same way. The differences are kind of around the edges. The differences are what language does the control unit speak? And by language, I mean which machine language does it speak? And some details of how things are wired up. Can the ALU directly access RAM? Or does it have to only access registers? That is a big difference between certain architectures. On the ARM architecture, the ALU only accesses registers. Question?
Is there a reason why you want to have the ALU avoid having the ALU accessing RAM directly?
Is there a reason for the ALU not to access RAM directly? The big reason is that then the ALU can be simpler in some ways, because accessing registers is so much faster than accessing RAM. So if the ALU can access RAM directly, then somewhere in there, there has to be additional logic, additional wiring, to account for the fact that you ask for something from RAM and it might not arrive for a while. It might not arrive for 100 instructions, because that's, you know, the ratio of the speed of RAM versus the speed of registers. Whereas if the ALU knows that it's only accessing registers, then the ALU can be built more simply. And in practice, that translates into the ALU can go faster. All right, so looking at this kind of diagram and thinking what kind of machine language and assembly language could this correspond to? Well, if you've taken COSE 126 here, you've seen toy. So what we're going to be doing for the next several weeks is basically the real version of toy, the non-toy version of toy. We're going to be looking at instructions that each take an opcode, an operation that the ALU is going to be doing. They might take, you know, source and destination registers. They might take, you know, additional information in the form of immediate values, and so on and so forth. Except instead of being kind of way simplified, we're going to be looking at what the CPU actually is doing. And it's not going to be as clean. It's not going to be as pretty. But it's going to be the real thing. So you're going to be able to write it, you're going to be able to assemble the code, and then you're going to be able to execute it on ARM Lab. All right, so let's plunge on in. Registers and RAM. So on our architecture, on the ARM architecture, the typical pattern is going to be that there is a set of instructions that is responsible for loading data from memory into registers. You're then going to have a set of instructions that manipulate the data entirely within registers, and then another set of instructions that stores the data back into RAM. So as I said, on ARM, this is the pattern you have to use because ALU instructions can't access RAM directly. And this is known as a load-store architecture. In contrast, something like x86 is what's known as a register memory architecture. So the way the whole thing is designed, individual instructions can access memory directly. So back in the 70s, when people wrote a lot of code in assembly language, this made their life a little bit easier. But what people didn't realize is that The trade-off was that it becomes harder to build the CPU and harder to make the CPU run really, really fast. And if you try to make an x86 chip run as fast as an ARM chip, it starts to melt on you. And for a big chunk of time in the early 2000s, Intel had this huge problem that their processors were melting when they tried to make them run faster. And it took them a long time and a lot of creativity to work around this problem of a register memory architecture. Now, that wasn't the only difference. The other difference is kind of this philosophy of how you design your instructions. ARM is an example of a RISC architecture, where the philosophy you have going in when you're designing it is that instructions should be simple. Don't make life easy on the assembly language programmer, because there's very little code written in assembly. Make life easier on the chip designer, who is going to be running, you know, the chip is going to be running code produced by an automated system, by a compiler. And so focus on making the chip efficient, making it run fast. The contrast to that is CISC, complex instruction set computers, where each individual assembly language or machine language instruction can do a lot more. It can access memory. There are instructions on CISC computers that look at four different registers, do a compare here, a swap there, you know, do all kinds of crazy manipulations, because it was thought that that might help assembly language programmers implement certain algorithms. So we're going to be living in this kind of RISC world, where the instructions we look at are relatively simple. So here are the registers that we care about on the ARM architecture. There are a few more registers that are kind of special purpose that the operating system cares about, but you, as an assembly language programmer, don't. So you can, you know, one thing that you see is that there are a couple of special purpose registers. We'll get to those later. But the majority of registers are just kind of numbered X0 through X30. These are 64-bit quantities. And you can access only half of them if you want. So if you want to treat them as 32-bit quantities, let's say you want them to correspond to ints in your code as opposed to longs, then you can refer to them in the assembly language as W0 through W30. And there are, you know, kind of instructions that operate on the full X registers. And the same instructions, you know, you flip a bit in machine language and they operate on the W registers. So they can be either 64-bit or 32-bit instructions. So X0 through X30 are known as general purpose registers. Because, you know, they're general purpose. You can use them for, you know, a lot of different things. You can use them as scratch space for instructions. You can use them to pass parameters to functions. You can, use them to store the address to which you're going to return when a function returns. You know, relatively general purpose. Now, as we learn more about the ARM instruction set, we'll see that some of them have special purposes. X30, for example, has a special role in hardware, where if you execute a certain kind of instruction, it looks for the argument in X30. Some of these registers, like X29, have a special purpose defined by software convention, where just if you want your software to work with other people's software, you have to use X29 in the same way. But for the most part, these registers are sort of interchangeable with each other. They're general purpose. The next register we're going to talk about is XZR. This is the zero register. If you try to read from this register, you get a bunch of zeros. You get either a 64-bit value of all zeros or a 32-bit value of zeros if you read WZR. If you try to write to this register, whatever you wrote gets thrown away. So, might seem a little useless, but it actually helps you get away with having fewer instructions because some common things you might want to do can be expressed as operations involving zero. And we'll see a couple of examples of that in about 9 slides-ish. Don't quote me on that. More special purpose registers. There's the SP register. This is known as the stack pointer. This is not like, you know, a stack as a data structure in your code. No. This is the call stack. This is where local variables go, as we've been talking about all semester. And the stack pointer points to where the current stack frame is in memory. So if you call a new function, it allocates some memory on the stack. The SP register gets updated to point to that. If you return from that function, it gets updated to point to the stack frame of the parent function. PC, program counter, another special purpose register. You very rarely manipulate this directly, but it is there, and it stores the address of the instruction you are executing. So if you're just executing code, it automatically gets incremented by 4 because instructions are 32 bits long. So it gets incremented by 4 bytes every time you execute an instruction. And if you execute a branch instruction, think of that as a go-to. So a branch instruction says, go execute code somewhere else. And the way that's done is by putting the address of the code you're about to execute in the PC register. But again, there are special instructions that do that. And finally, we have the PState register. So it's a special register that contains various state information about what the processor is doing. And in particular, your code cares about 4 bits within that PState register. These are the condition flags. Remember when I had this diagram of the ALU and it said it can output some flags? These are the flags that it can output. One flag says, was the result negative? One flag says, was the result 0? Yes or no? One flag says, did the instruction result in a carry? That is an unsigned overflow. And one flag says, did the instruction result in a signed overflow? So get to know these. You're going to actually be using them. And you know, a lot of code that executes things like if statements or loops effectively uses these flags. So questions so far? Yes? So X0 through X30 are numbered in decimal. So there are really 31 of those general purpose registers. Yes?
So the program counter and stack pointer, those are like physical registers in the CPU, right?
The program counter and stack pointer are registers in the CPU, but they're not general purpose registers. So you can't have, you know, a multiply instruction that uses the program counter or the stack pointer. There are special purpose registers, instructions that manipulate those registers in various ways.
So then for example, the stack pointer, is it pointing to like a physical address in the RAM or is it pointing to like some virtual address?
Great question. All of the registers that have addresses in them, whether these are program counters, stack pointer, or even general purpose registers that contain pointers, all of these are virtual addresses, at least when you're executing a user program. If you're writing an operating system, kind of all bets are off. There are some situations where you're actually looking at physical addresses, but most of the time you're still looking at virtual addresses. More questions? All right, let's look at some instructions now. So we're going to start by arithmetic instructions. In some sense, these are conceptually the simplest. So again, the pattern is that we're going to have an ALU. It takes an operation in, kind of which arithmetic operation you're trying to execute. And the most typical thing is that it executes on two source registers, produces a result, and sticks the result in a destination register. Now, any of the source and destination are allowed to be the same register. So it's a very common pattern that you will do an addition involving two registers and stick the result back in one of those registers. And that is completely allowed, and it completely works. Okay. So here's going to be the pattern of a lot of arithmetic instructions. We have the name of the instruction. This is going to be, you know, add, let's say. The name might optionally end in S. If it does end in S, then the interpretation is that you want the ALU to update those condition flags in P state. If you don't have an S, then the interpretation is leave the condition flags alone, just execute the instruction. And then you have a destination register, a source, and a source register. So three registers. Destination always goes on the left in ARM assembly language. Yes, that's backwards. Yes, it's, you know, what everybody does. There is, however, another pattern. You can say that I want to execute this instruction, set or not set condition codes. There's a destination register. There's one source register. But then I'm going to give a constant as the other operand. And this is known as an immediate value because the value isn't fetched from a register. The value is actually there encoded as part of the machine language instruction. Now, how big can this value be? Well, if you think about it, I already told you that all instructions are 32 bits long. And some of those bits have to encode what kind of instruction it is. They have to encode the destination register. They have to encode the first source register. So you can imagine that this immediate value actually has some restrictions on how big it can be and still fit within the instruction. So a little caveat, but if you're thinking of, you know, add 10 to this value, that'll fit. That's going to be fine. All right, let's look at a first example. So let's say we have some long variables, so 64 bits long. So we know that we're going to be using the X flavor of registers. And let's say that there's some good reason why we made these static. And let's say that some code that I'm going to tell you about later put the value of length in X1, the value of width in X2, and the value of perim in X3. So to execute this piece of C code, you actually need two assembly language instructions. First, we're going to add length plus width. Well, length is in X1, width is in X2. So we're going to add X1 and X2 and store the result in X3. Next, we need to multiply by 2. And we could do it in one of two ways. We could execute a mul instruction to actually execute a multiply, pass an immediate value of 2. But here, we're using one of the shortcuts that we talked about earlier in the semester, where we say that multiplication by 2 is the same as a left shift. So we're going to execute the left shift. So this is logical shift left. And we'll talk about what logical shift means in a couple of slides. But, you know, think of this as shift left. We're operating on register X3, which already holds the result of the addition. The immediate value is 1, so we're shifting left by 1 bit. And we're putting the result back in X3. So the net effect of these two instructions is to execute this one line of C code. Okay, questions on this? Yes?
So like LSL is like defined as an ALU instruction?
That's right. And there is a whole family of these ALU instructions for all of the basic arithmetic operations. So you have a sub, a mul, this is signed division. So division on signed values, ints and longs. This is a bitwise AND. This is a bitwise OR. For some reason, people like, you know, three-letter instructions, whatever. This is an exclusive OR. Whenever I write exclusive OR, I want to write the letter X and then OR. They made a different decision. I don't agree with it, but too bad. I got to live with it. And this is a right shift. And we'll talk about why this is called ASR and not LSR later. Now, remember that I said that there are these zero registers and that they are actually useful in some situations. Well, one of the most common operations you might want to do is take something that was in one register and move it to another register, copy it to another register. And indeed, the assembly language contains something that looks like move to X3 from X1. But this is a shortcut that the assembler gives you and does not actually correspond to a move instruction in machine language. If you look at what the assembler produces when you write move to X3 from X1, it actually produces a bitwise OR involving the zero register. So we know that 0 OR 0 is 0, 0 OR 1 is 1. So ORing with 0 doesn't change anything. So this takes X1, doesn't change it, and puts it in X3. Similarly, if you want to produce a negative of some value, you can subtract 0 minus that value, put the result in the destination register. So simple examples of how the zero register is actually useful for something. Yes?
So this means that in order to modify registers, we have to go through the ALU.
Absolutely. You have to go through the ALU in order to do anything with registers. Yes?
The reason we're doing OR is to say AND, or say like adding or something like
that. Doesn't matter. I mean, you could code it up as, you know, add 0. Sure. Yes?
The value of X1
will
still be in X1.
The value of X1 will still be in X1. When we say move in assembly language, we actually mean copy. Mm-hmm. Yes?
Do you achieve the same result by using just the constant that will load the arrows?
You could in some situations. If you're trying to do the equivalent of this subtract, the immediate value can only come second. So you can't use an immediate zero as the first operand of the subtract. That's why you need to do it this way. Any questions? All right. Next thing we're going to talk about is signed versus unsigned variables. And the answer to this is they don't exist. They're just contents of registers. Registers just store some bits. So it's up to how you interpret the content of those registers. And remember way back when we said that the algorithm for signed addition is the same as the algorithm for signed addition? Well, this shows up by there not being a signed add versus an unsigned add. There's just an add. The only difference is which condition flags you look at later to figure out whether you overflowed or something like that. And if you don't care about that, then there literally is no difference. And the assembly language shows no difference. You can't tell by looking at the code whether you're operating on signed or unsigned values, with some exceptions. So we're going to go over those exceptions. Here are the two major exceptions that you will see. They are division and they are right shift. So for division, you actually need different algorithms for signed versus unsigned divide. And this shows up as different instructions in the assembly language. For shift, all left shifts are the same. Right shifts, though, if you're going to take some number of bits and shift them to the right, well, if you have an unsigned value, you want zeros to appear on the left, always. If you have a signed value, and you want right shift to be interpreted as division by two, then if you have a positive number, that is the leftmost bit is zero, you want to shift in zeros. If you have a negative number, that is the leftmost bit is one, you want to shift in ones. And so there's an instruction, this ASR instruction, which is known as arithmetic right shift, that shifts in a copy of the leftmost bit when you do a right shift. And that is interpreted as signed division by a power of two. On the other hand, if you're going to be doing unsigned, you use the logical right shift instruction, which always shifts in zeros. But like I said, for left shift, there is no difference. You're always shifting zeros on the right. So there's only an LSL instruction. Okay, so these are the two situations where you actually use different instructions depending on whether you're signed or unsigned. Next, 32-bit. Pound include everything I just said about 64-bit instructions, but change all the X's to W's. The end. Okay, so you want to add a bunch of ints. You do an add instruction, but you use the W flavor of registers. The end. I have nothing more to say. 8-bit and 16-bit arithmetic does not exist. The end. Well, okay, so let's say you have a bunch of C code, and you have a care, and you want to do arithmetic on a care. How do you deal with that? Well, if you read the kind of language lawyery description of what happens in the C language, this instruction in C actually means take X, convert it to an int, increment the int, truncate it back to a care, store it back in the care. And the assembly language on ARM reflects that. So there are special load and store instructions for 8 and 16-bit quantities. But at the level of arithmetic, you're always operating on either the X register, 64 bits, or the W register, 32 bits long. Okay, so no special instructions for 8 and 16-bit arithmetic. Okay, any questions here? All right, let's look at some load store instructions. There is a load instruction, and there's a store instruction. They have this weird syntax. What do these brackets mean? Well, the brackets mean that when we say source in a load, that is not a memory address. That is a register. And the brackets say, dereference the contents of that register. Think of the register as a pointer. Read the contents of the register, interpret it as a pointer, read the memory address contained in the register. Similarly, for the destination of a store. All loads and stores on ARM are done through a pointer. Mind blown. Okay, so in order to read a variable, whether it's from the stack, the heap, RO data, wherever it is, you have to arrange for its address to wind up in a register, and then you call one of these instructions to read or write through that pointer. And here are the 8 and 16-bit instructions that I promised to tell you about. There's a collection of them, depending on whether you're using, you care about 8 bits, that's a byte, or 16 bits, that's a H half word. And depending on whether you're treating these as signed or unsigned, that is, take 8 bits, fill the rest of the register with zeros, or take 8 bits, fill the rest of the register with a copy of the sign bit, the leftmost bit. So this is known as sign extension. And these are the instructions that will do that. This says, take a byte, sign extend it to either 32 or 64 bits, and put it in the destination register. Okay, and in the 1 minute that we have left, we will actually see a full program. This is an assembly language program. We will step through it in great detail next time. But meanwhile, you can recognize here are some load instructions. There's an add, there's a left shift, there's a store, there's this move pseudo instruction, which we really know is a bitwise OR. And then there are these ADR instructions, which is how you actually get an address into a register. So as I said, we will step through this in great detail next time, and you'll also start seeing a lot of these details in preset.